Right, let's go. Good morning, everyone. I'm Alexis Strass-Hacker. I'm the Vice Chair of the San Francisco Regional Water Quality Control Board. I'm the acting chair for today's board meeting while Donald Young is away. Welcome to today's board meeting. Our meetings, as you know, are hybrid and recorded, so in addition to the in-person participants here in the auditorium, we may also receive public comments through our Zoom meeting platform. If you're not physically present and you intend to comment today, you need to be in the Zoom meeting space. If you haven't received a link for the Zoom meeting, you can visit our website and register through the link on the agenda. And after you register, you will receive a Zoom login link with access to the meeting. If you're here in person and wish to speak, you may also register online or with assistance from our team at the registration table just outside. Your registration isn't required, but it helps us to ensure you are heard. For those in the Zoom meeting, you'll be muted until it's your turn to speak. Our staff will then promote you. Please remember to accept the promotion to panelist and to unmute yourself so that we can hear you. When you're done speaking and the board members have completed asking any questions they may have, you'll be placed back on mute. And for those in the room waiting to speak, you'll be called by name if you've registered, or will be invited to speak after the registered parties. Please come down to the podium so that we can best see and hear you. All speakers will be given 3 minutes for commentary. Please state your name and your affiliate organization, if appropriate, when called upon. Thank you for joining us today. I very much appreciate seeing so many of our regional board staff and managers here with us. I'd like to ask Candace Yokoyama, our clerk for today's board meeting, to call the roll.
We have something for Eileen to say before we call roll.
Eileen has to introduce some attorneys.
Oh, yes. So thank you, Alexis. To my right here, beyond Ross, if you want to stand up, we have two attorneys who have been working us through the staffing transitions in our region. I wanted to introduce them. As you know, Yuri Wong retired in June, and David Lancaster here has been supporting us over the last several months. It turned out that Chech was on a much-deserved vacation back to see her family in Guam, and David filled in and helped us prepare for the board meeting. And then we also have Corinne Dorner, who just joined the Office of Chief Counsel, and she's going to be working part-time supporting our region and part-time supporting Region 5. So we want to welcome her to the Water Board. It's great to have them. And then as long as we're introducing new people, Mary Cousins, who I introduced, even though she wasn't here for the June board meeting, is our new MPDS Wastewater Division Manager. And you all know James, who helped prepare the permits today. But just wanted to introduce some of the new faces. So thank you.
Thank you, David and Corinne, for supporting us, and welcome. Let's go back to roll call.
Good morning. Board Member Ransom.
Here.
Board Member Gunther.
Here.
Board Member Batty.
Here.
Would you like to state if there's anyone present in the room with you?
There is no one present in the room with me.
Thank you. Board Member Kissinger?
Here.
And Vice Chair Hacker?
I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask for a motion and a second to approve Board Member Batty's request for an exception to participate remotely.
I'll move.
Moved by Board Member Kissinger?
Second.
Seconded by Board Member Ransom. Candace, could you please do the roll call vote?
Vice Chair Hacker?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
And Board Member Ransom?
Aye.
All right, the motion passes and the exception is approved under Government Code Section 11123.2, Subdivision J. We have a physical quorum for today's meeting and welcome everyone. And Jane, we hope for a strong and speedy recovery on your end.
I'm working on it. Thank you very much.
Let's turn to item 2 on our agenda, the public forum. I'd like to open our meeting to the public forum and remind everyone that public forum is not for items on today's agenda. You can speak on those items at the appropriate time. It is also not for items that are a pending or an impending matter, meaning they're about to come up on our agenda in the next few months. If you have questions, please consult our board clerk, Candace Yokoyama. I'll now call on each of the public speakers who have registered to speak. If you're remote and haven't been called, please raise your virtual hand on the Zoom platform. That way we'll know you're waiting to speak. Each speaker is allowed 3 minutes. You'll be timed and notified. You can see the timer visible on the screen. I believe we have at least two registrations. Would you like to start with that?
That's correct. First up, we have Susan Schwartz.
Please go ahead. Susan, can you hear us?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I hope you can see me. Good morning. I'm Susan Schwartz, head of all-volunteer Friends of Five Creeks. We've worked on local watersheds for 30 years. I hope you will all ask for a thorough report on both the urgent threats to valuable wetlands and what we see as long-term neglect in Berkeley's Aquatic Park. This park is mainly a set of artificial lagoons. Hastily built during the Great Depression, it kept a straight offshore feeder to the Bay Bridge from becoming a cesspool of sewage and pollution from West Berkeley, just across the transcontinental tracks on the old shoreline bluff. The lagoons never worked right. The pipes were inadequate. Berkeley didn't clean them. What became I-80 offshore added to the pollution, and there were fish kills and stinking algae by the end of World War II. In the post-war boom years, Berkeley further blocked circulation with landfill west of I-80 and stepped up using the lagoons as side exits from its two largest stormwater outfalls to keep West Berkeley from flooding. When U-floats started taking hold in the 1970s, Berkeley pacified you with a bypass pipe. This still shoots polluted runoff into the lagoons from antiquated industrial pipes and tanks. They're still there. Then as you develop MERPs and C3 hydromodification, not much visible happened. Your staff recently discovered that Berkeley's Aquatic Park has no 303D listing because your typo conflated it with San Francisco's Aquatic Park. So for you, these eutrophying lagoons, shoaling from sediment, circulation pipes clogged, periodic fish kills, periodic or frequent yellow and black scum or dead diatoms and thready algae, and unsafe for fishing and body contact, are pristine. On the east border, West Berkeley's high groundwater and shallow aquifer percolates through the old shoreline bluff. It forms a narrow wetland with cattails, a couple of lovely ponds, and little creeks winding to the lagoon. These treat 150 years of legacy pollutants, the job of the expensive rain gardens your permit requires at the top of the bluff. In the crowded urban rail corridor, this was the most logical place to reshuffle trains while a bottleneck at the Port of Oakland gets fixed. Berkeley missed or ignored multiple notices from 2020 on. Fish and game had bowed out by 2000. That left you folks with shaky authority. Your staff got concessions that left more space for the park. But you also certified a plan that mapped the wetlands incorrectly, denies the existence of all but one creek, and requires no mitigation and only minimal short-term replanting, which could easily wipe out the only native rush. As I speak, the railroad has done, the railroad has done its massive clearing and extremely steep loose dirt and rock loom directly over these wetlands. Please ask for a report on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. I appreciate your attention to this. I will note a whole group of volunteers pulled large armchairs out of Aquatic Park on Saturday using kayaks and other such inventive ways. So there's much yet to be done. Do you want to add anything, Keith or Eileen?
Just that, you know, our staff continue to work with the city of Berkeley, the railway, and we've been responsive to her. So as you know, it's a very complex issue, and our staff continue to work diligently on it. So thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Our next registered speaker.
Alexis, can I just add something?
Please do, Jane.
I just wanted to thank the woman who just spoke and all the volunteers. This sort of citizen engagement is so important. And I know from past years on the board that it's been a little while since that I've heard from the Berkeley folks, but I appreciate them coming today. And I'm sure our staff will do everything they can to support them. But thank you for speaking up.
Susan, you and Friends of Five Creeks are certainly welcome to return and keep us updated on your concern. Our next speaker?
Next up is Nicole Sasaki.
Nicole, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Please go ahead.
Good morning, Vice Chair Hacker and board members. I'm Nicole Sasaki, speaking on behalf of San Francisco Baykeeper. I am here to bring your attention to selenium pollution in North San Francisco Bay. For over a decade, Baykeeper has appeared before this board asking for more stringent selenium regulations. We commented on the North Bay selenium TMDL in 2015, the EPA Bay Delta selenium criterion proposal in 2016, the Phillips 66 permit in 2016, the triennial review in 2021 and 2024, the Martinez refining permit in 2022, the Chevron Richmond permit in 2023, and the Phillips 66 permit in 2024. In each of those proceedings, Baykeeper said the same thing. The numeric targets adopted for the 2015 North Bay selenium TMDL, 8 micrograms per gram whole body fish tissue, 11.3 micrograms per gram muscle tissue, and 0.5 micrograms per liter dissolved water column, are not protective of fish and never will be. The best way to protect fish is to update the water quality objective for selenium. However, the 2015 TMDL did not adopt water quality objectives. In fact, the legally binding water quality objective for selenium in North San Francisco Bay is still the 1992 National Toxics Rules water column criterion of 5 micrograms per liter, which all parties agree does not protect fish. Between 2015 and present, Baykeeper has repeatedly asked this board to update the water quality objective for selenium. During that time, the board could have used its authority under Porter Cologne, but has chosen not to. Baykeeper isn't just upset that we're not getting our way. Our concerns about the North Bay selenium TMDL are supported by science. The 2019-2020 work by Stuart Fayer, Johnson, and Son resolved any remaining doubts. Sacramento splittail in the bay are exceeding egg, ovary, and liver thresholds for selenium while simultaneously passing the TMDL's muscle tissue target. Moreover, white sturgeon are exceeding the muscle tissue target itself in dry water years, with 47% exceeding the target in 2015 and 44% in 2016. The authors of Stuart 2020 say it directly. Muscle tissue criteria, like in the North Bay TMDL, may be underprotective. The TMDL targets were never protective enough, and the fish data confirm it. At next month's board meeting, Baykeeper will again comment to share the science of how selenium bioaccumulates through the food web, why fish tissue beyond muscle tissue matters, and what the most recent monitoring shows. Thank you for your time.
Nicole, thank you to you and Baykeeper for your continued attention to this matter, and we look forward to your continued engagement. I think that, as many of us know, the mere tackling of water quality objectives and revising them is no small matter, but rather a multi-year commitment with ever diminished resources. So I'd like to ask you and our team to engage on what is the art of the possible with regard to selenium and water quality objective development. But thank you again for your comments. Eileen, do you want to add anything?
No, I think your comments were excellent, Alexis, and we're happy to engage Nicole like we do on so many other matters and sit down with you and your team. So thank you for coming today.
All right. Do we have anyone else registered to speak?
We do not.
Is there anyone in the room who would like to speak? Very well. Public forum is now closed. I'd like to turn to the minutes of our June 10th board meeting, which are in our packets. Are there any edits or revisions to these minutes? Jane, none?
None.
I was unexpectedly and unavoidably absent, so I'll need to not vote on this. May I ask for a motion to approve the minutes with as written?
So moved.
I'll second.
So it was moved by Board Member Gunther and seconded by Board Member Kissinger. Candace, would you take a roll call vote, please?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Batty.
Aye.
And Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
Very well. The minutes are approved. Thank you all. Let's turn to agenda item 4, which are board member updates, and then our executive officer's report. I'd like to welcome Jared Blumenfeld, our State Water Board liaison, who I had served with Jared when he was the EPA Region 9 Regional Administrator and when he was the Cal EPA Secretary. We are very fortunate to have Jared as our State Water Board member. Jared, welcome.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hacker, board members, and Director White. Alexis, it's really a privilege to get to work with you. I think of all the people that I've got the opportunity to work with in my decades of environmental work, you're definitely at the top of the most professional, collaborative, thoughtful, engaging, and just think about all the people that you've helped mentor over the years that are now in environmental leadership positions over the state. So really a privilege to get to report and be the liaison to Region 2. I live here in Marin. I lived 25 years in San Francisco. So this is a place that I not only live, but spend a lot of time out on the bay, fishing, swimming, doing all kinds of things. So to the other board members, great to meet you. I just want to thank you for your service. This is an incredibly time-consuming and complex and, you know, very, very, very important role that you're not paid for, that you spend, probably everyone who is in your life is like, how could you spend so much time on this regional board role? I just want to thank you. It really, for me, is emblematic of how democracy can work and work well is when people come together from all different walks of life and make decisions on complex issues like this. So thank you. I'm going to always be very, very brief. You have lots on your docket of important work. My job is really just to give you a very thumbnail sketch of what's happening at the state board so that you can understand and ask any questions. My goal is to have as tight a relationship between the regional boards and the state board as possible. That sometimes works well, sometimes doesn't. I had a great lunch with Eileen and Alexis to think and strategize about how we could do some of that work. So thank you both for reaching out and being so collaborative. So first on my list is Delta Conveyance. We have a hearing resuming on August 20th. With SUR rebuttal phase beginning. This remains one of the state's most important ongoing water rights proceedings and will continue into early September. Second, the state board is moving forward with the tribal beneficial uses document. The draft statewide guidance has been released and tribal consultation and public comment will continue through the 31st of August. The goal is to provide greater clarity around how tribal beneficial uses are designated and incorporated into water quality control plans. One of the ones that will be the first test of this will actually be the update to the Bay Delta plan, which is on the docket for the state board later this month. Third, there's several significant state regulatory actions. These include the draft statewide small MS4 stormwater general permit and the utility wildfire general order. Fourth, drinking water is an important part of the board's work and all of your work as well. On 18th of August, the board will consider adoption of the 26-27 drinking water state revolving fund intended use plan. For those listening, I think we often think of drinking water as a problem in the Central Valley and parts further away than Region 2. But this region, the Bay Area region, actually has its fair share of long-term systems, mainly small systems that have not been in compliance for a variety of reasons. And so these stubborn issues need to be resolved. It's hard to believe that there are people in California, let alone in the Bay Area, that still don't have access to safe and affordable drinking water. Finally, the State Board continues to actively manage water supply and drought conditions, including curtailments in the Scott and Shasta River watersheds and development of new water supply demand and allocation tools to support decisions during this period of shortage. So in very broad terms, the state focus right now is on major water right decisions, water quality regulation, tribal water interests, drought and water supply, and making investments in safe drinking water. Thank you. That concludes my report, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Jared. Do board members have comments or questions?
I do.
Please go ahead, Jane.
Jared, it's so nice to meet you, and I look forward to connecting with you in this new role. I just want to make a shout out to my dear friends in Pescadero, California, who are one of those small communities that are very much still struggling on safe drinking water. Eileen and Alexis and, you know, everyone has been very supportive, but they have some significant issues that will require deep engagement from San Mateo County. And so I appreciate you keeping an eye on that for us.
I will. And I love, I think it's called Duarte's. They have a Owala berry pie that is to die for. So I am willing to solve nearly any solution, any problem we'll find a solution to if we just go there. So I'm ready to roll up my sleeves. And the last time I went to Pescadero, I bicycled there for some reason. And it's an amazing part of your.
It's an amazing place with serious, serious drinking water issues. And yep. We'll set up a field trip as soon as you're ready and I can walk.
I hope that is soon.
That sounds like a great plan. A pie-informed field trip to understand these issues. We'll figure it out. Anything else while we have Jared here? If not,
I've got
Bill.
One question. First off, nice to meet you.
Good to meet you.
So I'm curious, I haven't thought about the alternate conveyance in some time, but it's been out there for a long time. What is the timetable at this point for development and ultimately, if it's approval of the alternate conveyance?
That's a great question. Partly, our lawyers are very, very focused on this being a kind of adjudicatory ex parte focused hearing. And so even things like the schedule fall under those. But I can get you a rough sense of the timetable. I asked that very question myself last week, so I will get you something.
Great. Thank you.
Jared, thank you so much, and we look forward to this relationship continuing and hearing, bringing together what's happening on your end at State Board with what we're up to here in the region. Let me turn to individual board members for an update. Jane, would you like to lead with anything?
I don't really have anything today. I'm just going to mention two quick things that, according to our garden, fall is on the way. And with all local predictions of a very wet winter. So I'll just share that. And I find myself asking regularly, are we at all keeping up with what we need to do on the climate front? And I don't expect an answer on that today, but it's on my mind, as I'm sure it is everyone else's. And thanks.
Thanks, Jane. Mark? All right. Bill?
Nothing for me.
Empty.
Yeah, I wanted to just give a brief update about what's happening at BCDC. And I have a slide that maybe will appear here, which I presented at the last BCDC meeting. Yeah, so these are temperatures in the United States, I think July 15th. Every time I see one of these things, it's always amazing to me. This is not a random chance that the temperature in San Francisco is so drastically below everything else that you see in the United States. We are blessed to live next to, you know, one of the four great upwelling zones on the planet. And this provides us with a real leg up in resilience to climate change. It's not that we're not going to have heat waves, we're not going to have higher temperatures, but it's simply not going to be as bad as in other places. That's because we have this natural air conditioner. It's really almost like a public utility. Yes, indeed. And I see this as one of the bases to help us build a regional response to climate change, because everybody in the region benefits from this physical phenomenon. But the big challenge, of course, for us is going to be sea level rise, because we have so much intertidal area in the Bay Area. Sediment and Beneficial Reuse Working Group at BCDC that I chair is held a public workshop in early June, where the staff presented a variety of different policy ideas and had sort of a general brainstorming operation. It was very well attended, and I'm really very excited about where we're heading with this. I think that we will be able to come up with a Bay Plan amendment that I think will be circulating in the next few weeks, where we're going to be able to make changes in the Bay Plan that are going to help stimulate the beneficial reuse of sediment, so that we won't be taking the sediment, which we need to modify our shorelines over the next several decades. We won't be dumping it out in the ocean. We'll be reusing it, but we'll also be, I think, reusing it more broadly. Even if we can't get it into wetlands, we'll be using it to recharge mudflats and putting the sediment back into the regional system that circulates it. It does mean, of course, we will probably be redredging some of that material over time, but it's here for us to use as we improve our ability to find the resources to beneficially reuse it, to build the, as I say, the living edge of the estuary. I was actually just walking yesterday out in Eden Landing at high tide, and it's a pretty extraordinary experience now, different than it was 10 years ago. I mean, you get out there and you're in the scale of the wetlands that you are in the middle of, and you just get a feeling of how much they can help us protect the shoreline from sea level rise. Well, of course, also providing almost an incredible wildlife and outdoors experience. So that's what BCDC is doing. The other thing which you may have seen in the news is that NOAA is conducting an assessment of California coastal agencies pursuant to Coastal Zone Management Act. This was something that was completed in late 2024 and never finalized by NOAA, and now it's being redone. And I have to say, when you read the language that was in the letter that Secretary Lutnick sent to NOAA to kick this off, it's really an incredibly political operation. I encourage you all to take a look at Chairman Wasserman's comments which was at the public hearing, I think it was yesterday, pointing this out. I am not exactly clear where this is going to go. NOAA had no problems with our coastal zone management activities as of November 2024. You'll just have to kind of watch this space to see what happens. But those are the things that are happening at BCDC.
Thank you. Apropos dredging, I was invited by the Army Corps and CMANC to speak at a dredging meeting in Sacramento on July 16th, and I just wanted to mention three things that came from that that were new to me, though probably not new to those of you who work in this area. At the Corps nationally, there's a shift to greater standardization of a national dredging program. They, for next fiscal year, which will begin for them on October 1st, they will have an interim national team and see greater consolidation. And so the South Pacific Division, in which we're situated, will be partnered up with the South Atlantic Division, and there will be greater standardization of procurement, greater consolidation of requirements in the interest of being more efficient and streamlined, which led to, you know, the pull and tug around how do you bring in the specific concerns and uniqueness of particular ports on the West Coast and the statewide perspective. So message one is for us to focus on the new contracting mechanisms and how they may work and how much flexibility we can introduce with our core partners. Secondly, has to do with the timing of depth surveys prior to the start of dredging. So the authorized depth is a key issue for the Corps. It's strategically timed by the Corps, but sometimes it's not optimized to the actual start of the project itself. And some of the things that we and our partners like BCDC bring to dredging, like the species protecting windows. And so there was a lot of pressure, particularly from smaller ports like Stockton, to not segment the dredging, you know, to do an entire, in a common sense way, a very long stretch of depth survey rather than some not connected chunks, if you could put it in non-technical terms. So secondly, a focus on authorized depth, which is a very key to cost. And lastly, the third issue that I took away from it was the availability of disposal and placement sites. We know we have Montezuma at least for the next 5 years, but we also know, as Andy just noted, where can we put sediment in addition to the authorized sites and how do we work with the Corps. So I found it a really interesting discussion because there were bar pilots and other parties in the conversation about their practical issues, but everybody seemed quite concerned about what the forthcoming standardization portends for their particular interest. I'll leave this topic with a quote from General Lloyd. Quote, "We don't need to boil the ocean, we just need to make something better," which I thought was memorable for me. I have to remember not to boil the ocean. So, on that note, let's turn to the Executive Officer's report.
Great, thank you. Before I dive into the updates today, I want to share with you the tragic loss of our former colleague, John Madigan, Water Resource Control Engineer in the MPDS Wastewater Division. If you recall, John received a Superior Accomplishment Award for his outstanding achievements, including the reissuance of the Lehigh Southwest Cement Company's MPDS permit at our June board meeting. John's come before the board on several occasions throughout his 20-year career with the Water Board. His ability to juggle divergent views, regulatory requirements, and thoughtful initiative enabled him to make a significant impact on water quality throughout the Bay. John represented the best of what it means to be a civil servant, a team player, a mentor, and a true leader. His energy and passion will be sorely missed by all of us. In terms of the executive officer report, I want to highlight an overarching theme, something that John truly embraced. Our commitment to water quality extends beyond our basic regulatory requirements. We believe in supporting each other, collaborating with our partners and our colleagues, and driving our mission to restore, preserve, and enhance the waters of the Bay Area. In this month's report, we shared how the fireworks general permit has proven effective, and we highlighted our collaborative work with several third parties, including coordinating with a local enforcement agency at Keller Cannon Landfill to identify and mitigate subsurface oxidation. We shared our knowledge on the site cleanup work during the Transforming Shorelines Collaborative meeting hosted by the San Francisco Estuary Partnership. We provided vapor intrusion mitigation guidance training to the Santa Ana Regional Board, And we've been helping communities to adopt to new regulations, as we did with a conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for grazing operations in the North Bay with the various workshops we put on. It's through this kind of collaboration that we have become better partners in restoring, preserving, and enhancing water quality. And I'm proud of the work we do to make this mission a reality. And now with that, I'm actually very excited to present two state-sustained superior accomplishment awards. The sustained awards I'm sharing with you today are given in recognition of staff rising above and beyond for a period of more than 2 years. These are individuals who have made a difference on behalf of the state of California by positively impacting the work that we do for the public and the communities we serve for a sustained period of time. Recipients are nominated for these awards by our management team and are vetted through a committee with the State Water Board on a yearly basis. Once a nomination is accepted and approved, each recipient receives a financial bonus, a formal certificate, and a presentation before the board and the public. The first award is presented to Catherine Ward. Catherine, if you want to stand up. She's an engineer and geologist. Great. She's an engineer and geologist in the Toxic Cleanup Division. Catherine received the Superior Accomplishment Award for her contributions preparing a significant number of regulatory actions for the many cases she manages. She has one of the highest productivity records in our region. One of the regulatory actions that she prepared was a cleanup and abatement order for a complex site with five different dischargers and a half-mile-long containment plume that impacted a drinking water well. As part of preparing the cleanup and abatement order, she led monthly meetings with a group of dischargers and numerous attorneys who were suing each other in an insurance lawsuit. She did it graciously and professionally, and they were all very pleased with her involvement. So I just want to say that I've actually had the opportunity. I want to give credit John Wolfenton, who is here today. Thank you, John, who was her supervisor, approached me about nominating her. And he has worked very closely with her, and I totally was in agreement with him, and I've seen her work personally. Also, just some other things she has embarked on that I've got to see and witness is she was chairperson for our in-house training committee, where she facilitated monthly committee meetings with a team and led the committee in planning the training that we do each year for the regional board staff. And as I've mentioned, we have numerous new staff. In the last several years, half our staff have turned over. And so it's really important that we continue the training. So she works with the team to identify what are our gaps, what do we need most, and then develops the training plan. She's also serves as the member of the team that coordinates the site cleanup program with State Board and is our representative there. She's also, and I've got to work with her closely, a member of our Recruiting for Racial Equity team in our region. And in that role, she took the lead in putting together and being our professional organization liaison. So she created a tracking list of different professional organizations that staff can join to network and advance their own professional development, but also to get the word out about the Water Board. And that's how we've been successful in being able to bring in some very talented people externally. She's also created a list of networking events that have got staff interested in attending so they can expand their network. In short, and I've got to witness it personally, her strong technical and organizational skills combined with her excellent communication skills and her passion for protecting water quality have resulted in her numerous contributions to the Water Board, and we're very grateful to have you on our team. So thank you. And next, I'd like to share our second awardee. Before then, we'll take a short break and go outside and take pictures. Our next Sustained Superior Accomplishment Award is for Kim Yee, our Regional Board Human Resource Liaison. I think everybody at this table can say we all support it. Kim is amazing. She has served in this role at the Water Board for 10 years, and she first started as a student intern right out of Cal back in 2012. Throughout this time, she has mastered and excelled at responding to numerous HR requests from staff, supervisors, managers, and executives within our region. She's educated all of us on the hiring practices, on preparing offer letters, on helping us through the recruitment process. She's patient, she's thorough, she's got attention to detail, and she has developed very effective relationships with Sacramento. She has become the go-to expert providing insight, guidance, clarity, and direction for all personnel matters, with outstanding attention to accuracy, confidentiality, and professionalism. This work includes for management support also of personnel contracts and budgeting needs within the region, guiding supervisors and managers to resolve outstanding items. Her incredible patience and tenacity was demonstrated through the complexity of the working through the issues with State Board on the Bay Restoration Regulatory Integration Team, or BRIT, contract. She was very patient as she worked through with them, the Coastal Conservancy, and other parties to get this contract through. She never gives up. She consistently steps in to support others as needed. As we've been hiring new supervisors and managers, she not only onboards them, but as they're doing their own hiring now, she's the one that does the most in educating them about what the hiring process is, the spreadsheets that we need, the entire process. She does it with a smile, and or she has time for everybody. She's also supported us in our transition. As you recall, we've gone through a couple management services managers in the last few years, and she, although I've tried to get her to apply for the job, she hasn't wanted to, but she has onboarded, helped onboard our new managers, and it's just been invaluable to all of us. She's also been recognized numerous times in our region, but I just want to take the time today to just say she's been an invaluable resource for all of us, not just for the managers, but as she onboards each new person. And she consistently delivers exceptional service, going above and beyond her daily responsibilities as our HR liaison. So with that, Kim, if you want to stand up. And she always does it with a smile. So with that, I'd like to suggest we take a short break to go outside to get photos with the board with our two recipients.
What we're going to do is take a break for 10 minutes. We're going to reconvene at 9:50, reestablish or reconfirm a quorum. Jane, this is a good time to turn off the camera for 10 minutes, and we'll see you then. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate how taking a break sometimes engenders all of these wonderful conversations. So I like the energy in the room. Three things. One, I'd like to reconfirm that we have a quorum, having returned from our break. Secondly, this morning, as we took a board vote to grant an exception to allow board member Batty to participate remotely, I think I hurried us through that part of the meeting, and we need to just ask Jane to give a little bit more detail so that we're fully compliant with that requirement. Jane? You're muted. Can you start over? There we go.
Sorry about that. Do you have me now?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought I was going to get away with not talking about it, but I was doing an unofficial review of the Carmel River watershed in June, just after our last board meeting, and I fractured my ankle in three places, and so I am pretty confined to home and a lovely chair that I have here. So I hope to see you, but probably not until October. It's a very long recovery. So I'm here until then.
Oh, my goodness.
The board chair and I were discussing during the break having our next board meeting at your house.
I think that'd be great. Yeah. Come on over. We'll get all our friends from Pescadero to come visit as well.
All right. We could... All right. With that, I'd like to move on. We have a couple of permits on our agenda, and I need, before we proceed with the board items, I'm going to administer the oath for today's hearing. Before I do, I believe that we need to address, of the two items, Board Member Kissinger, do you want to make a statement? And then I'll administer the oath.
I do. I'd like to state for the record that I'm a partner at the law firm Morgan, Lewis & Bockius, which has represented CNH on the water board matters related to the enforcement of a previous permit, and to avoid any potential conflicts of interest and the appearance of bias, I'm going to recuse myself from this matter. So
very well. We will. I will proceed with the oath, then we'll take item 5A, and then we'll ask Bill to rejoin us before we consider item 5B. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested parties. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witness by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this process. Additionally, written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise and raise their hand. Do you promise to tell the truth? Thank you. For the record, I note that we still meet the quorum requirement with the exception provided for Board Member Batty under Government Code Section 11123.2, Subdivision J. Eileen, now, would you like to continue with Item 5A?
Yes, thank you, Vice Chair Hacker. Item 5A is the reissuance of the NPDES permit for the CNH Sherwood Company and Crockett Community Services District. The revised tentative order would reissue the existing NPDES permit that regulates discharges from the CNH Sherwood Company refinery and the joint treatment plant. CNH operates and owns the sugar refinery, and it also fully operates and owns the majority of the joint treatment plant, which is partially owned by the Crockett Community Services District. The sugar refinery intakes water from Carquinez Strait for cooling, and the joint treatment plant treats sugar refining wastewater and pre-treated domestic and commercial wastewater from the community of Crockett. We did not receive comments on the draft permit, and staff are available to answer any questions about this item.
Candace, do we have any members of the public that would like to comment on this item?
We do. We have John Paul Napote remotely.
Very well. Do you want to proceed with his comment? John, would you go ahead?
Yes, excuse me. I just wanted to thank staff for their work on this permit, and then I was just attending the meeting to answer any questions that anyone may have.
Well, thank you very much. Please hold while I check in if we have any additional speakers, and if not, we'll turn to board members.
No additional speakers.
Do I have any questions or comments from the board? I've got one question. Go ahead, Board Member Gunther.
So this facility is jointly owned and operated by the private company and the public district.
This is James Parrish, Senior Environmental Scientist in the NPDES Division. Short answer is yes.
And is this a unique facility in Region 2, or are there other such jointly owned and operated facilities?
This is a unique facility for us in Region 2. Yeah.
I have a question in reading the permit, and thank you for your work on this. There seemed to be just a pattern of effluent violations and things that in some cases were attributable to equipment failure or other circumstances. I note the new additions to this permit and wanted to just ask, in your professional opinion, will they be better positioned to be in full compliance through this coming permit term?
Short answer, yes. We've been in a lot of engagement with CNH through past enforcement and through the development of this permit, and so we do expect improved operations in this next permit term.
Mary, anything? Eileen, anything to add?
No, I would just recommend the board adopt item 5A, the reissuance of the NPDES permit for CNH Sherwood Company in the Crockett Community Services District.
Jane, is there anything? I want to make sure I check in with you.
Sorry, looking for the buttons. No, I am fine.
Very well. Is there a motion and a second to approve uncontested item 5A?
So moved. Second.
It was moved by Board Member Gunther and seconded by Board Member Ransom. Candace, would you call the roll, please?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Batty.
Aye.
And Vice Chair Hacker.
Aye. Thank you. Item 5A has been adopted by the board. Julie, if you'd notify Board Member Kissinger, I wanted to thank our permit writer, Debbie Fan, and both of you for your work in renewing this permit. Thank you so much. All right. As soon as Bill rejoins us, we are ready for our next item on the agenda. We'll just take about half a minute.
Well, then I can take the opportunity to do my normal bowing down to the staff who create these consent calendar items out of what I know is a very complicated and controversial and challenging situation. There's just so much work has to go into put something like this on a consent calendar, and I will never stop thanking you guys for making that happen.
Agreed. All right, Eileen, we're ready for our next item on today's agenda. Board Member Kissinger has rejoined us. Go ahead, Eileen.
Great. Thank you, Vice Chair Hacker. Item 5B is the reissuance of the MPDS permit for the Livermore Amador Valley Water Management Agency, also known as LAVMA. This revised tentative order would reissue the MPDS permit for LAVMA's intermittent wet weather discharge. LAVMA is a joint powers authority that receives secondary treated wastewater from the Dublin San Ramon Service District and the City of Livermore wastewater treatment plants and discharges the combined effluent to the East Bay Dischargers Association, known as EBDA, common outfall. This draft permit regulates intermittent discharges to San Lorenzo Creek and Alamo Canal through shallow water outfalls during extreme wet weather and discharge maintenance exercises. We received no comments on the draft permit, and staff are available to answer questions about this item.
Can you say how you pronounce the acronym again?
It's a mouthful.
Indeed, indeed. Candace, do we have any members of the public that wish to comment on this item?
We have Levi Fuller in person to answer any questions.
Very well. Do we have any comments or questions from the board?
Yeah.
Board Member Gunther?
I have a question. The discharge during extreme, any facility that is discharging during extreme wet weather is going to be, it's going to have to be up to the challenge this winter, I think. And I'm wondering whether in any kind of categorical way we can make sure that the operators of facilities like this are ready for, you know, getting a month of rain in an afternoon, which seems to be, you know, we have no guarantee that's going to happen, but it could happen. And I'm just wondering whether we're talking about rainfall for which these facilities are not designed, I assume. So, Eileen, is there any way that we are able to maybe just send out a letter that, or somehow encourage those who operate these facilities? I doubt it's necessary, but I think that it's an important acknowledgement that we may be facing a real challenge in the coming winter.
Right, and definitely our permit writers can, you know, they have their contacts and they can talk to them. I think a lot, it's in the news a lot, so I think a lot of the wastewater agencies, and I know one in particular that I used to work with, we started our wet weather training in the summer because you don't use, during the summer you don't, and they do the exercises and there's the extra maintenance that has to come. So basically, most of the wastewater, I don't want to say all, and you're right about the predictions for this winter, but they do their wet weather prep, so they're ready by October 1st, because that starts the beginning of the water season, really, in the rain. And so a lot of them are doing their exercises and practicing now. James and his team can always reach out to individual ones. I mean, we've been fortunate over the last few years, we haven't seen big violations, but as you noted, for these really huge atmospheric rivers, and if we get ones back to back, that becomes very challenging for the wastewater agencies, and they're usually in close communication with us. But a lot of them are using this time now to prepare.
And I didn't know whether our MERP permittees are also, I guess I would just like the water board itself to make sure that we have communicated to our permittees that we appear to be entering a season that could be unlike anything they have experienced, and just encourage everybody to think outside the box and be ready for what might happen. And I don't know if there's a mechanism to do that. I will leave it to you. You don't have to commit to any one thing, but I agree that the El Nino is breaking through. The knowledge appears to be breaking through in a way, and I think the onslaught of extreme weather that we're seeing around the world in the Northern Hemisphere is helping people kind of sort of realizing that kind of it's hitting the fan here. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we fulfilled our obligation to try and make sure that we minimize any impacts. And that, to me, would just be double-checking with our permittees that they are, you know, aware that this is coming and that it's, I appreciate regular training and everything, and maybe there's nothing we can do, but I think that the scale of what we could see is pretty astonishing, and it's up to each individual facility owner to run scenarios about how their things are going to operate, but I'm a little, I'm just a little concerned that the scale of what could happen, which is outside our normal operating parameters, has not necessarily been, everybody hasn't necessarily engaged with that, but maybe I'm wrong. I just want to make sure we help kind of people.
I hear you, and I in particular have been talking to some of the wastewater agencies regarding this in various forms, but I think your point's well taken, and they all have their permit requirements, but it's one thing to have a permit requirement and then translating what you're hearing in the news and doing the prep, that we meet regularly with BAQA, you know, and that's an easy way for us to just put it on an agenda, just, you know, want to make sure you guys are doing extra prep, haven't, you know, manage a large wastewater plant. We made sure we got the maintenance done early when we knew big atmospheric rivers coming in, had extra staff on overtime, you know, had them planted there, because a lot of times the worst storms come in the middle of the night, on the weekend, but we can have that dialogue, and we're very lucky that we, you know, meet regularly with the BAQA agencies. That's very easy way to just kind of, it's part of our engagement with them, so I think that's a great idea.
In your experience to this moment, are you finding that our permittees are thinking about it in a systematic way?
I think a lot of them are.
Okay, good.
Yes.
I did not ask, as we began our board questions and comments, I didn't ask if there was anyone in the room who would like to comment or anyone else who's popped up on Zoom.
No more registered speakers.
Very well, thanks. Any further board questions or comments? If not, Eileen, would you give us your recommendation?
Yes, thank you. I recommend the board adopt item 5B, the reissuance of the MPDS permit for Livermore Amador Valley Water Management Agency.
Very well. Is there a motion and a second to approve item 5B?
So moved.
I'll second.
It was moved by board member Ransom and seconded by board member Kissinger. Candace, would you call the roll, please?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Batty.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
And Vice Chair Hacker.
Aye. Very well. Item 5B has been adopted by the board. We are ready for the next item on today's agenda, which is the Department of Defense cleanup program. If you wish, we could take a one-minute break for those who need to come and go. So why don't we just stand for 1 minute, and then we'll launch into item six. We're going to continue now with item six, which is the Department of Defense cleanup program. We're going to focus on funding challenges and what are the impacts on the programs. All right. I'd like to turn it over to our executive officer.
Great. Thank you, Vice Chair Hacker. Our next item is an informational item on the Department of Defense cleanup program. Selena Hernandez, Senior Engineer and Geologist in the Groundwater Protection Division, will provide an overview of the Department of Defense cleanup program. She'll describe the federal and state funding process, our funding constraints, and the associated program impacts. I'm now going to turn it over to Selena.
Good morning, Vice Chair and board members. My name is Selena Hernandez. I'm in the Groundwater Protection Division. About 2 years ago, some of you may have been here when I updated you on our program's priorities and accomplishments. Today, I will discuss the funding challenges that we've had since then and how it affects our program. I want to highlight that last week things escalated. We received formal notice from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers grants officer that all regulatory activities under the current Defense and State Memorandum of Agreement have been suspended until further notice. We do not have a formal explanation, but this appears to be part of a broader nationwide issue affecting specifically DSMOA cooperative agreements. With that, I'll continue with my presentation as planned. I'll start with the presentation outline. First, I'll begin with our program overview and then discuss some funding. I'll provide how the funding challenges have affected our program. Then I will provide some specific facility examples on how this has affected our work. And I'll close with some future considerations. Throughout the presentation, I will refer to Department of Defense as DOD or military, and I'll also explain some of the other acronyms. Let's get into our program and funding. Here is a map of our DOD cleanup facilities. We currently have 17 funded facilities grouped by five DOD components, and those are Defense Energy Support Center, or DESC, and you might see the legend on the top left. DESC are pink bars. Then we have the Navy, which are the blue bars. Formerly used defense sites, or FUDs, are yellow. Army are red bars. And Air Force are orange bars. I'll highlight some of the facilities on our map. First, Hunters Point Shipyard in San Francisco receives the most funding statewide. Travis Air Force Base in the north is in Solano County, and that's one of our active facilities. Military Ocean Terminal Concord is an active Army facility, and it's also DOD's West Coast ammunition seaport. In the South Bay in Santa Clara, there's Moffett Field. In my last update, I discussed the cleanup that was occurring at Hangar 1, and in December 2025, they fully restored Hangar 1. DOD funding has two buckets: the components, which I shared in the last slide, and the funding programs. Every project is tracked by who's paying, the component, and what type of site it is, the funding program. There are three funding programs: Base Realignment and Closure, or BRAC, which funds work at our closed facilities; Installation Restoration, or IR, funds work at our active facilities; and Military Munitions Response Program, or MMRP, funds munitions response work at both active and closed facilities. Next, I'll review the funding process elements. The funding process is complex for DOD, and it takes about a year. I will explain the key elements that are needed to obtain DOD funding. First, on the left, DSMOA, or Defense and State Memorandum of Agreement, which is basically a master service contract with DOD and the state agencies that sets the ground rules and reimbursement framework. Department of Toxic Substance Control serves as the state's DSMOA coordinator. The DSMOA six-step process is completed by DOD and the state agencies to set the scope, schedule, and budget for each facility for a two-year period. The State Water Board resolution sets the Water Board's reimbursement limit or budget cap. We cannot bill above this limit. The cooperative agreement is a two-year agreement between the DOD and the state agencies that allocates the funding. This is the last step in the DSMOA six-step process. DTSC is the sole recipient of the funding, and they sign the contract with DOD. After the cooperative agreement is signed, DTSC works with the other state agencies to establish interagency agreements. This agreement is simply the contract that allows us to get reimbursed for our oversight, with DTSC as the state's coordinator. Now let's look at some numbers. I'll show you how we ended up with the Water Board's statewide budget for fiscal years 2026 through 2028. We started with Water Board's estimate of $30 million, which includes the State Water Board and Regional Water Board's time to oversee the facilities. State Water Board reduced that to $21 million to meet our updated budget cap of $10.5 million per year. This is equal to a 31% reduction from the Water Board's original estimate. Then DOD reduced that to about $16.4 million, which is equal to 22% reduction from what State Water Board actually requested. Overall, this is a 46% reduction from our original Water Board's estimate. Now we'll look at how this played out for Region 2. Region 2's estimate was about $6.4 million. State Water Board reduced that to about $4.8 million, which was equivalent to a 25% reduction from our original estimate. Then DOD reduced that to about $3.1 million. That equals a 36% reduction from what State Water Board requested. And overall, that's a 52% reduction from our original estimate. As you can see, these cuts occur at two levels, from State Water Board and DOD. And it's clear that the budget approved doesn't cover all the oversight that's needed. Let's look at this another way. There's a lot of information on this graph, and I'll walk you through it. First, I'll introduce a new metric, personnel years, or PY. Personnel years represents one full-time employee working for 1 year. It's simply a measure of how much staff time our budget can support, our budget meaning Region 2. The x-axis shows over a six-year period from 2022 to 2028, Water Board's approved DOD budget. The number above the years is the actual approved amount. So in 2022 to 2024, we received $8.5 million per year, which met our budget cap of $8.5 million. The next 2 years, we received $7 million, which is below our budget cap. And then recently, we received a little over $8 million, which is under our updated budget cap of $10.5 million. The y-axis on the right corresponds to the blue bars, which shows Region 2's portion of the approved statewide budget. Each year we receive between $1.9 and $1.5 million, and there's clearly a decreasing trend. But between 2024 and 2028, we got about $1.5 to $1.6 million, which isn't really a significant change. The y-axis on the left corresponds to the orange dashed line at the top, which are personnel years for Region 2. The downward trend is clear here. You got 6.3 from 2022 down to about just under 4 PY in our current fiscal year. Current two-year contract, sorry. That's equal to a 38% reduction over the six-year period. So you may be wondering why staffing has dropped so much between 2024 and 2028 when the budget really hasn't. The simple reason is salaries and overhead costs are higher, and those increases have only recently been accounted for in our budget. With higher operating costs, there's less funding available for actual staff time. Currently, we have 9 staff and 3 managers, but our budget is for 4 full-time staff, or 4 PY. Next, I'll discuss how the funding challenges have affected our program at both the federal and state level. As I mentioned earlier, last week we had to stop work on all our military work until further notice. This stop work applies only to regulatory activities under the current DSMOA cooperative agreement. Obviously, this has impacted our military cleanup work significantly. Overall, these funding challenges and the DSMOA stop work will delay activities and the transfer of property back to local communities. Before I discuss our program impacts, I wanted to introduce some of the federal challenges. Over the past year, the federal government, including DOD, has experienced significant funding constraints, staffing reductions, and reorganization. As a result, DOD's capacity to manage and implement the work has been greatly reduced. To cope, DOD is focusing on some top priorities, and those are addressing PFAS impacts in drinking water and maintaining existing cleanup remedies. This leads to our program impacts that I'll get into next. First, I'll discuss stop work directives. We've been forced to stop work to avoid exceeding the budget in the cooperative agreement. The cooperative agreement also allows the federal government to terminate it at any time. We've had 4 stop agreements over the past year and a half. The first occurred in March 2025 for all 7 of our Navy BRAC facilities through the end of the fiscal year to June 2025. The second occurred in April 2026 for 2 Army installation restoration facilities. Then in June, we were directed to also suspend work on the munitions sites for the Army, in addition to continuing the stop work for the installation restoration facilities. And the fourth occurred last week. We were directed to stop work on the regulatory activities under our current DSMOA cooperative agreement. The next program impact is workload redistribution. The budget constraints have forced us to shift work in different programs. We are taking on more cases in site cleanup, underground storage tank, and national pollutant discharge elimination system programs. Historically, our staff have spent about 70% of their time overseeing military cleanup facilities and about 30% of their time overseeing site cleanup program sites. But under current conditions, we're forced to shift our workload into the other programs. Although the redistribution maintains staff productivity and we support other regional water board priorities, the DOD project schedules are disrupted. And the DSMOA stop work means that we'll have to shift more of our work into the other programs, and there'll be more project delays. The last program impact is task reprioritization. The reduced budgets force us to reevaluate and reprioritize the tasks planned at each facility. This requires a lot of communication with DOD and the other regulatory agencies to update the project schedule and the tasks. Again, this delays cleanup activities and ultimately property transfers. And the DSMOA regulatory activity stop work means that when we resume work, we're going to have to work hard to reprioritize our tasks more. Now I will provide some examples of how reprioritization has affected specific facilities. Petroleum closures have been postponed at Alameda Naval Air Station, Hunters Point Naval Shipyard, and Treasure Island. PFAS surface water discharges have been deprioritized at Treasure Island and at Travis Air Force Base. PFAS cleanup completion has been delayed to the year 2070 at Travis Air Force Base. And the Desmoa stop work leads only to more delays across all of our facilities. As we move forward, we will use the following to guide us. Prepare for continued DoD funding constraints. Continue proactive coordination, communication, and budget management. Maintain our commitment to protecting public health and the environment. And manage the current Desmoa regulatory activity stop work, which is still very fresh. Lastly, I just want to thank our team for their dedication and resilience. Even with the nationwide stop work and all the uncertainties, they continue to show professionalism, flexibility, and support for one another, all of which keeps me going too. I'd also like to thank everyone that's helped me with this, prepare this update. It's been a long one. With that, I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Thank you so much, Selena. I'm sure everyone has something to say on this point. Bill, would you like to start?
Absolutely. I guess my first question, but I ask it in a snarky way, is how this makes America great again. But you don't have to answer that question. I assume this is a nationwide suspension?
Yes.
And is there, I know the answer to this question, but is there any rationale offered for the suspension and a timeline for when they're going to conclude the suspension?
So I'd like to take that because while she was giving the presentation, I just got an email. initial email we got was because of some position at the federal government was vacant regarding funding, and that had to be filled to approve this whole agreement that, Selena, the Desmoa agreement. And then I just got forwarded an email from the acting deputy assistant secretary of the war and saying that it came to their attention a week ago, and so they're committing by the end of this week to have some sort of path forward or resolution. So hopefully, when we got the word, our first reaction, Selena, Nathan, Jessica, Ross, and I was, whoa, is this going to go on for 6 months, a year? As you've already seen, the program's been impacted over the years significantly, and then this was just, we had already planned this. We had planned this presentation that we're going to do this months ago and then got this. So reading this email, I'm hopeful that today's Wednesday, by the end of the week, we do have an update from the federal government. And they did say in their email that, you know, they see the impacts and they understand the importance of working together to support and expedite environmental restoration activities at these various bases. So at least it got to somebody's, because originally it came from someone at the Corps saying some position was vacant. So that's the latest that went out from, you know, very high up at the Army, and they committed to try to have it resolved by the end of this week.
Okay, well, I'll leave my more intemperate comments to the side for the meantime. Actually, just a couple specific questions. The military ocean facilities, is that still an active site? Do they still use it? I guess I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
On the west side.
I know it was always, I know that's what it was historically, but I didn't know it was still active.
Yep, still active.
And they're storing materials there, or they're just using it as a place where they bring it in and out by train and then send it out by ship?
That sounds extreme.
It's amazing. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
I do just want to clarify that to make sure that you all understand that it is specific to the Desmoa cooperative agreement, so not all military cleanup is under a Desmoa agreement. So
but those have all been suspended, but that work has all been suspended
yeah.
as well, just was suspended earlier. Mm-hmm. It's sort of an astonishing break with the cooperative relationship that's long been in place. And it, I mean, it's going to be a very lively political issue when it really gets to, you know, political into Congress. I mean, I don't know how they can sit to the side for very long.
Well, and that might be why we got this email. My understanding is the governor's office was made aware. Since this was nationwide, I don't know, but he may be, have connected with other governors. But it sounds like maybe because it was nationwide and some of them were talking, that it sounds like it's going to hopefully be resolved sooner rather than later. But there are concerns when we got the word last week. Is this 6 months? Is this a year? Meanwhile, the people at Hunter's Point have put up with decades of this environmental pollution. And same with all the other sites. So it was very concerning to us.
This sounds like a bipartisan issue. So
it does.
Board Member Gunther?
Yeah, I was trying to understand the relationship between the sounds like you're, the email is about the Dismoa suspension, but that's one of four or five. The Army project stopped, and then the Navy project stopped. I mean, it's like all work. It sounds like a vast majority of our work has come to a halt because the federal government has issued stop work orders. Does any of this, I mean, I'm just thinking about like for cause or not for cause. I mean, why is the Army decided a year ago that they issued a stop work order? I mean, are we told why, or are we just told the money tap is being turned off and you have to deal with it?
Well, the ones from the past, like in 2025, and then the recent one in 2026, those were related to our expenditures. The Army was a little bit different. The Army's, it is still associated with the cooperative agreement, but they were mainly about the expenditures. The Dismoa stop work that we just had last week is more about the contract and agreement itself. And under those, so each state has their own Dismoa agreement, and with that, there's like a list of all the different facilities that are part of that, that will be funded, that get the allocated funding. So we received our allocation July 1st, and then last week we got this whole Dismoa stop work.
So the previous, you said they're related to our expenditures. Does that mean that we were charging too much to these agreements?
Do you want to speak to
that? Yeah. Just to be clear, all DoD work in our region has been stopped. Selena was just referring to some states don't have Dismoa agreements, so just to be clear about that. And when she's talking about expenditures, we do, as you saw in the presentation, we don't receive enough money to do the work that we're asked to do. So even before the fiscal year begins, we know that we're going to run out of money in the middle of the year. So at the beginning of fiscal year 24-25, for example, we predicted we would run out of money for Hunter's Point Shipyard, Treasure Island, and Alameda Naval Air Station in January. So it's no surprise that we reach our budget cap, as we like to call it. That's not the official name, but it's not surprising that we run out of money in the fiscal year each year recently.
But the money you're talking about is to fund the oversight work that we're doing. I mean, the facts on the ground are no work is being done because of this suspension by DOD. So, I mean,
I believe the DOD is still doing work. We're not allowed to do our regulatory oversight work.
And the work that they're doing includes doing the reporting function that they already have? So the reports are showing up here, but we're just not able to.
Yes, that's what happens when we're asked to stop work, is the Department of Defense continues on, and we request that they extend our review deadlines. We have deadlines that we have to meet, so we're obligated to review things in a timely manner, maybe 30 days or 60 days, for example, depending on the type of report. So the DoD continues to work.
Are we, though, prohibited from doing the work, or it's just simply we just don't have the money to?
We are asked not to do work that we're not able to obtain reimbursement for, so State Water Board directs us to stop work.
And we followed up last week with State Board exec saying, you know, we'd like to do this. Could we do it and then, like, do a cost recovery agreement later? We were trying to brainstorm with them because we have the staff to do the work. This is important, critical work. It's been going on for decades. And at that point in time, you know, they wanted to make sure we were following the stop work order. And, you know, we were told that this, at this point in time, we must stop all work on these projects.
I'm sorry, I'm confused. I understand about the one that just happened, the Dismoa one, okay. But you presented three or four others, in some in 2025, one in 2026. Now, you said that we routinely run out of money, and we know that ahead of time. So you're saying yes. That those items you put on the screen weren't orders from the Department of Defense. They were us reaching the end of the appropriated funds.
Yeah, so for example, in March of 2025, we were asked to stop work on the Navy BRAC facilities from March through June, and that's because we had expended the budget that we had for those facilities.
And that request actually comes from the State Board.
The State Water Board asks us to stop work when we've expended all of the budget.
And you know that's coming.
At that time, so we last gave the DoD program update to the board at the beginning of 2024. So this is a new issue for us. Previously, we didn't have eyes on the budget like we do now. Previously, State Water Board wasn't invoicing. We didn't even have a cooperative agreement until really late into the fiscal year that year with DTSC. We weren't getting budget updates. We didn't know how much was being expended. We had never had a budget issue before, so we were directed to just do the work.
You don't create the budget yourself?
What happens is the Department of Defense components, through the DSMOA portal, they put all of the tasks that need to be done into that portal, and then we estimate how many hours we need to do all of those tasks. And so that's how we get our budget estimate. That's what we need to do the work that the DoD is asking us to do. That's usually around 38.1 personnel year.
I think I'm getting it now. You're saying that you budget, you estimate the hours based on the job.
Yes, based on what we're asked to do.
You don't know whether there's enough money to do the job.
We know there's not enough because they ask us to do 38.1 PY worth of work. We tell State Water Board we need 38.1 PY worth of money or more, actually, in this last DSMOA cycle. And then the State Water Board is really only able to ask the DoD for 28 PY worth of money. So we are not able to ask the Department of Defense for the amount of money that we need.
You're not, yes, but I guess you're not asked, can you do this job for 28 PY? That's not how it works.
No, it's not how it works.
You know, and I'm coming at this as a consultant who, of course, would never be in this situation at the beginning.
I'm happy we're having this conversation. I want you to ask all the questions.
You say it's going to be 31 PY or whatever to do the job, and at some point you know pretty soon that you're not going to have that much time. And so you just go on your merry way until you, and you know, okay, it looks like we'll run out in March, and then we'll have to stop work until July 1st, and then we'll start again.
It's quite complicated because we do go through an effort to reduce the tasks. So we work very closely with the Department of Defense, all of our staff, many of whom are here, we work with them to, you know, they ask us to do 20 things, for example, at one facility, and then we say, well, we didn't get enough funding for that. So we work with them to prioritize, identify what is the highest priority at the site, what needs to get done, where can we make the most impact this fiscal year, what contracts do you actually have awarded, what are you actually going to be able to get done during this two-year period. So we work very hard to take all of that work that they have projected that they'd like to get done. And then we really spend a lot of time trying to make that more realistic with the money that we have during every year.
Right. But what I'm trying to get at is the reprioritization and like your the budget is really just kind of sort of a hand waving exercise. Then I'm just talking about just for our staff, the idea is that you know going into the fiscal year that you're not going to be able to be doing this work in May. You're going to be doing something else. And you guys are able to efficiently organize us so that our highly trained and expert staff are not just sitting on their hands for the last 3 months of the year. They're doing something else that had been planned ahead of time. So it's just, it's not like it's one day I come to work and I'm told, can't do that anymore. This is all according to our own internal plan. We're ready for this, is kind of what I'm saying.
It did come as a bit of a surprise in March of 2025. But yes, our staff are extremely adaptive, and it's amazing the work that Nathan and Selena do to manage the program. Our staff are able to do stormwater inspections in the MPDS program. They've been picking up a lot of UST.
Okay. That's where I was going with this, is that we're never going to get the Department of Defense to do what we want them to do. That's clearly a losing battle. But we're able to utilize our staff to achieve our goals, and we try and achieve our DOD-related goals whenever the funding is available, but we have adapted to this. Really, we work on a 9-month year with the Department of Defense or whatever.
Yeah, it depends on the component and the funding source, but our staff find a way to do the highest priority work. It's really incredible. We find a way to do enforcement. We have some enforcement attorneys assigned that's not funded by DSMOA. Mm-hmm. So we do, Nathan and Selena and the staff, they do an excellent job. It's incredible. And we have, you know, people like Judy Huang at the Travis Air Force Base, you know, advocating for time-critical removal actions and really pushing to get things done with very little.
This is clearly an entire subspecialty that we have adapted to. And
it's unfortunate because we could see it coming. And as early as May of 2024, we were meeting with State Water Board advocating for. We contacted the State Water Board attorney and asked them, like, can we get cost recovery agreements set up? How can we bill them outside of DSMOA? Can we raise our cap? We've been advocating for years to try to address this issue.
And do we keep the affected communities apprised of the fact that there's going to be we're going to have to stop work for a while? I mean, is that I assume that wouldn't be very popular.
Yeah, you know, I think they noticed that we're gone because, you know, we were asked to stop work last week and we couldn't attend the RAB meetings for Hunters Point Shipyard, or Ross and Mary Snow were going to attend a EPA listening session and we weren't able to attend. So I would have to get back to you on how we're communicating that to the public, but.
And I just add for San Francisco, because they're very interested in the transfer of the property at Hunters Point, and they came to the big exec meeting that Jessica and I went to earlier this year in San Diego. I did contact them, the head of the department, and just when I provided Selena's excellent staff summary report and told them, I just want to let you know your date for the transfer of Hunters Point to the city of San Francisco is a pipe dream, and that it's years away because of this ongoing issue. So the reality is our staff do a fabulous job. They're resilient. They'll jump in, and as Jessica says, they'll start doing stormwater work. They'll do MPDS work. They're very adaptable. But the impact is to these communities. These sites are getting cleaned up much slower, the review, and this has been going on for years, and it's really gotten worse the last few years, and thought we need to be transparent to our board because we came and gave a presentation 2 years ago on Hunters Point. It's a top priority. It's in an EJ community. Well, that's going much slower right now, and we don't even have staff working on it, and we don't know when they're going to start.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad that you did this. This is very helpful, and I would just I wouldn't want our staff to be bearing pain at the local level because the financial rug gets yanked out from under them by the Department of Defense. I clearly would hope we communicate exactly what's going on so that the communities affected can complain to the right place.
Right.
Okay.
Jane? I'll turn to Jane and then to Mark.
And then I'd like to come back on too.
Thanks. I sort of wanted to follow up where Eileen was headed with this conversation, which is about ultimately about the community impacts. So particularly Hunter's Point, Eileen, as you bring up, I mean, they have been waiting for so long and it's been such a big project. So I, you know, sort of for the record, would love you to talk a little bit more, or the team to talk a little bit about more about community impacts, and also specifically about PFAS at Travis Air Force Base. And I'm sure there are other areas, but at Travis, heavily populated area again, that the new date is 2070. And I was wondering what the prior date was. So maybe could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'll deal with Hunter's Point and then let Jessica and Selena talk about the PFAS. With regard to Hunter's Point, there's a particular group within the city department that's committed to getting this, you know, land. There's going to be developing on it. And, you know, I've developed a good rapport with him, and he's very ambitious and enthusiastic, and it's really great to work with him. But I had to just share with him Selena's great staff summary report, and I sent it to him last week and said, after you read it, feel free, you know, give me a call. You can listen to our board meeting. I'm happy to talk with you. But I just want to let you know the reality is it's not getting transferred to the city for years, and this is why. And one of the reasons I went to him rather than just a community member is I think the mayor of San Francisco can be influential with the federal government. This is a top priority of his. It's decades these people in Hunter's Point have been putting up with this environmental pollution as a result of the federal government activities. So I thought it was the most strategic approach for us, and he reports directly to the mayor. And so and we're in close communication on some other items. So I felt it was the best way to try to hear our message out there with somebody who could potentially make a difference. And then with that, I'm going to let Selena.
Eileen, can I just ask you, what was the transfer date supposed to be? What year?
Do you remember, Jessica, for or Nathan? For it's different parcels, but I mean, basically, and Nathan, feel free to chime in here. Nathan King is a supervisor of the Hunter's Point site. Do you recall? I know they're all different dates. Or Mary, feel free. Mary does a great job. Mary goes to all our community meetings. Right. They're going to miss her.
You can go to the podium.
Since she can't go anymore, but go right ahead, Mary.
Sorry. Yeah, they parcel by parcel is the plan for transfer. They're currently expediting the transfer of parcel G. And for those of you who've been around Hunter's Point for long, it was parcel 49. It was going to be the 49ers Stadium, circa 1990, whatever. Anyway, so that parcel was initially planned to be transferred in 2028. We're now at about 2030, but they're doing the building demos and all of that. But again, our oversight is fits and starts over the last 2 years.
Thank
and then
you.
The other parcels are more into the 2036 time frame.
Okay.
Mary, would you mind answering the question about how we communicated the stop work to the public?
Oh, yeah. So we were notified on Tuesday afternoon, and we had a EPA was presenting a listening session to the community for Hunter's Point, and I notified the chair of the Citizens Advisory Committee for Hunter's Point that afternoon as soon as I knew we wouldn't be able to attend. So I communicate with Dr. Honeycutt, and she likes to be the sort of mouthpiece of the community, and she is the chair of the Citizens Advisory Committee at the behest of the mayor. So I did notify her.
The second part of Jane's question had to do with PFAS.
Yes, thank you. My name is Nathan King. I'm a senior engineering geologist. I work with Selena and Jessica. Travis, as well as Hunter's Point, are two of the bases in my section. The question was, if I remember it correctly, why is it going to take till 2070 to clean up the PFAS? And that was before the stop work, just so we're clear. And it also does include decades of monitoring. So we're in the remedial investigation stage at this point. It has to proceed through the cleanup stage, so to speak. And then after that, they're proposing decades of monitoring.
Thank you.
Apropos that comment, is there any extraction and treatment at this stage, or are they waiting for a remedy?
So one of the things that we are engaging with them, or we were engaging with them, Judy Wong is the remedial project manager. She has been really pushing for removal actions in known contaminated areas to speed that process up and to reduce the impacts to surface water and groundwater. And it's one of the things that Judy is very good at is negotiations, and we were making great headway with that, and we got the stop work. So or this new news from Eileen, the email is hopeful, and I hope we could get back to doing the good work. And the Air Force was receptive to it. So they realize how long it's going to take, and there are people drinking it, and ongoing discharges of surface water need to be addressed.
Thank you, Nathan. Jane, do you have any follow-up?
Oh, I'll just say that it's hard to believe that clean water, clean soil, clean air is not a bipartisan issue.
Let me turn to Board Member Ransom and then Bill.
Just a quick question. I mean, some of these projects have developers, you know, all in, you know, high-profile projects. And having worked with a lot of developers, I can't imagine that they're standing on the sidelines watching this happen idly. So is there any hope? You know, I heard the word cost recovery. You know, so I've seen situations, recognizing it's complicated, where developers can advance some oversight, you know, with a cost recovery. Is that on the table?
Yeah, so at this point, we talked to State Board Executive Management earlier this week because that's what we were hoping for. We as a team, it's an awesome team, I have to say, and they're really great to work with. And we brainstormed, and then I called Executive Management State Board, and they didn't want that on the table at this point in time, they said. So we have to be respectful. They wanted to see what the governor's approach was going to be. So we're respecting the process, but we wanted to plant the seed with them that we don't want this going on indefinitely because it's impacting. But at this time, it's not on the table with State Board. But as I said, I did bring it up with a department head in San Francisco who's got developers ready to go. So, yeah.
Board Member Kissinger.
So I guess I see this as two distinct issues. One issue is the actual remedial work process, whether that's being done, and that's a DOD decision because they're the ones that are carrying out the remedies. And the other piece is the oversight piece, which is a DOD decision in part, but it's also a State Board issue in the sense that they've issued a stop work order to us. And I understand their budgets, and you know, we have scarce resources to begin with, and this was the budget's kind of assumed you'd have these resources. If in fact the work is being done but is being delayed because we're not able to carry out the oversight function, those numbers are small by comparison, you know, a few million dollars a year, which, you know, it's a lot of money to individuals, but to the government is nothing. And so it does strike me that Sacramento has to figure out a way to come up with that money, because the one thing we don't want to do is, in effect, be a tool that the DOD can turn on and turn off by their commitment to pay or not pay these cooperative agreement obligations. And you know, I don't know whether the answer is ultimately some kind of litigation strategy or some kind of threatened litigation strategy, but we can't allow that to happen. Sacramento, and I'm speaking more broadly to the State Board, we can't let that happen. This work has to continue, and if the work is not getting done, that's something we have to put a bright light on. But we don't want to be the agency that gets pointed at for failing to, you know, respond to the, you know, to the reports that are coming out and ultimately the remedies that are going to be selected by virtue of that work. And I come back to Hunter's point. I mean, we've talked about it for so long. We do these, you know, biennial reports, you know, that are so unsatisfying given the length of time. And the idea that it's going to be drawn out multiple years longer is terrible. It's completely unacceptable. So.
And the reason we're escalating this and escalating it upper levels of state board is because we share that concern. And we've seen at Hunter's Point that the community's lost all confidence in basically the Navy to clean up, given what happened with Tetra Tech. I mean, you know, people went to jail. There was falsified records. So there's a real role for the regulatory oversight, and our team does such a good job. So
what a great strategy to prevent us from doing that work by us agreeing to, okay, well, we'll have to stop because we don't have any money that you guys have already cut. I mean, ridiculous.
Yeah, so we're hoping for a broader strategy if it's not resolved quickly.
Yeah.
Absent this unexpected cessation of work, I'm struck by two things. One, the way that the process itself, this incredibly time-consuming process that yields a two-year interagency agreement and money comes from it, is not the optimal way to fund us, especially given that you go to the good faith effort of putting forward what would it take to do this task, only to have in each situation the amount handed out to be diminished notably. I thought those slides were very effective in telling a story, but I'm wondering if there's not a way to explore with State Board, how do we get ahead of that so that the State Board, there's no point in you estimating that the task takes X hours if the State Board is going to give you half of X hours. And so can we explore with State Board a better process going forward so that we can more assuredly rely on not having it cut at every single phase of the process? I know through the budget process this new state fiscal year, there are positions that were restored to State Board. I don't know if any of them were restored to the DOD cleanup program, but I was struck in the materials that the board members received. This affects every single one of the 9 regional boards. And so I'm wondering, Eileen, if when Donald, you and I go to the chairs meeting in a couple of months, because it's of interest to all the boards, could we have a more robust conversation with all the other board members and the executive management team around this larger question? Like, how do we make this process work better for us so that you can plan work throughout the state fiscal year?
And I'd be open to doing that. Jessica, she's done a great job. I've been involved in meetings with exec. I don't know, Jessica, if you want to, you know, share a little bit about your discussions.
Yeah, we've been talking with State Water Board since 2024 about the budget issues and advocating for asking for more money. And they did raise our reimbursement limit in 2026 from 8.5 to 10.5 million. They were not able to raise it more than that. And there's reasons for that. But they have committed to continue to try to make the situation better. And it's so complex, I don't know how much into the weeds we want to get, but I would say that there is a point to us estimating the money that we need, because if we don't do that, then no one will know what our needs are and that they aren't being met. And also, that is how funds are distributed percentage-wise across all the facilities. Yeah. Unfortunately, at the facilities that have the biggest budgets, State Water Board cuts those at a much higher percentage because they have more money. There is a thought that those budgets have more wiggle room, so to speak. Not my words. mm-hmm. And so that those budgets can be reduced by a lot more than the smaller budgets. So we're just doing our best.
Yep, I can see that. Eileen, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I guess just in summary, I just want to thank our incredible team. Selena, Nathan, Mary, Jessica, all their staff, they do an amazing job. They'll bounce into doing stormwater inspections, whatever we need, MPDS. But I think the bigger issue isn't keeping them busy with useful, work that is very useful, but I think we want to get across the impact to these communities that, you know, Hunters Point, every time we get one of these, not enough budget. It's just delays the transfers of these projects, delays the transfer of not only the properties, but the cleanup, and, you know, meanwhile they have to live with what's at. And we're just hopeful to somehow get the funding we need. Our staff does an excellent job. It's just, I thought Selena's graphic was so clear. I told her when I first saw it about, you know, the red numbers, and you see the overall, that this has been going on for quite a while, and we're just trying to be transparent to the board and the public.
Jessica? Yeah, and just one fact that didn't make its way into the staff summary report, but I was saying that the budget is cut more for the facilities that are more complex and have larger budgets. And for example, at Hunters Point Shipyard, Naval Shipyard, for this 2-year cycle, we had requested a certain amount of hours. I think it's about 2,800 hours per year. And we received 34% of the hours that we had requested. So if you look at the big picture in our presentation, you're seeing overall, we're receiving about 50% of our need, but it's really facility and component specific. And Hunters Point Naval Shipyard being one of the biggest, most complex, important facilities in the nation, it's hard for us to do our work when we receive such a small percentage of what the need is.
I'm going to turn to whether there's any public comment or commenters in the room or on Zoom. I had purposefully inverted this in our normal order of business so that we could hear from board members, but we, as board members, will certainly want to hear the outcome of any updates, Eileen, over the next week or two. I don't think we're in a position to have our own unique communications in the Cal EPA family around this, but I do encourage our team to be forthright in the appropriate public settings about what the present impact is, so that people don't think we're just not engaged, but that we're not there for a very specific reason, that we're not authorized to work on this at this time. You could see how much concern exists among board members and in support of the vital role you play, and I wanted to thank you for an excellent briefing that engendered such vigorous discussion. Let me ask, Candace, are there any commenters?
No registered speakers.
Is there anyone in the room who would like to comment? I'm sure that people who are working in this program have lots they'd like to say, but we won't do that at the moment. Oh, my goodness. So we look forward to an update on this, both from you or through the executive officer's report. Okay. Any last word on this topic from board members? If not, I have a couple of closing comments. I wanted to thank our board clerk, Candace, with the support she had from Wes and Julie. Thank you for supporting us so well through this. Thank you to our three attorneys. What a wealth from Chuck, Corrine, and David. Thank you for supporting us. And I'd like to thank our AGP team for making possible this hybrid broadcast, Dakota, Andrew, and Adrian. With that, the board will not be meeting in closed session today, because we have nothing scheduled and we have not received any correspondence. So this will conclude the public session of the August 12th San Francisco Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting. I really appreciate all the staff, managers, and others who have joined us today. Our next meeting is scheduled for September 9th in this very room. And with that, we're adjourned.